You are listening to WPVMLP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Sunny and hot across western North Carolina today with a high near 96. A chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms this afternoon and this evening. Some of those storms could be strong to severe. Our low tonight going down to around 70. For Independence Day, a 30% chance of showers and storms, mainly after about 3 p.m. Mostly sunny and hot, the high near 95. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. In the past few weeks, I've moved away from having guests on the show, and I've been going solo. I like going solo because it gives me an opportunity to explore ideas and things I've been thinking about and do it with you, like we were sitting in a cafe having a conversation, like I was yesterday at Elevation Cafe in Taos when Michelle Potter and I were sitting outside at a small table sipping coffee and talking about adventures and writing and different kinds of things. And Michelle was curious about recording more videos, more sound files. So we were talking about how to do it, how to be comfortable while you're doing what I'm doing right now, how to trust the beats that come out. And I didn't really have an explanation for her other than to say that over the years, I've memorized lots and lots of poems, and I've done many, many shows on Twice 5 Miles Radio, almost 10 years, maybe a little more than 10 years, airing them on WPVM-FM in Asheville and KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. And by the way, if you'd like to hear any of the shows, you can search Twice 5 Miles Radio and they will pop up wherever you get your podcasts. So as Michelle and I were talking, I tried to explain to her that the poems that I've memorized, the material that I've had with me, inside me, by heart, however you want to call it, are not particularly poems that I can call up right away. And yet, having all of that information buried or flowing around inside of my body, my psychology, my mind, where do you remember something? Do you remember it in your toes? Do you remember it in your knees? I think it might be throughout the whole body. So all of that material somehow bubbles up when I'm expressing myself like I'm doing now. And I may use very little of it, but there's some sort of foundational thing that happens with all of that memorized material that allows me to trust whatever is coming out in the moment. Like right now, I'm sitting here at the table, the wind is blowing, I hear some birds over in the bushes. The clouds are fluffy. It's a blue sky day in New Mexico. I trust that in this moment, describing that just now was exactly what was needed for the unfolding that's happening as I tell this story. Radio art is storytelling, if it's anything. And I think one of the reasons I love the solo pieces, doing it by myself, is that it allows me to flow with no interruptions. I don't have to craft questions. I don't have to think about what the narrative will be from the beginning to the end. I just let it unfold. And in a sense, I'm interviewing something. Not interviewing myself. I'm interviewing maybe the ideas that are floating around. So one of the things that I've been enjoying lately, I went through some of my archives. A lot of what I have is in North Carolina, in plastic boxes, years and years of journals. I started doing a hardback journal, writing a hardback journal in 1987. Prior to that, I had loose leaf notebooks. None of it is literary. Mostly it's just verbiage, some complaints, and yet there are dates. And there are observations, cultural observations. And one of the things I'm finding interesting these days, thinking about all of this work that we do, and I'm assuming that you do some too. Maybe you don't. Maybe you have no interest in writing or storytelling. You're just listening to this show because you happen to be driving down the main street there in Taos, or perhaps you're driving down Merriman Avenue in Asheville or somewhere else in the world, and you're just listening to it to pass the time while you wait at the red light. Or maybe you do have an interest in storytelling and writing and that sort of thing. So if, in fact, you do have that kind of interest and you do keep a journal, you may be someone who keeps the Morning Pages journal based on Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, or you may just write journals on your own. However you do it, the journal writing that you do, that I do, that people you know do, will endure for the next 400 years. Now, not all of it. Much of it will get tossed away. You will pass along and you won't be on Earth anymore. And your granddaughter will find the box of journals that you've kept, and maybe she will archive it. Maybe she won't. Maybe she'll toss it. Who knows? Maybe she'll put it in the very basement of some large house that's a family house. And 400 years from now, maybe the house is still in the family. It's a bit of a stretch, I know, but perhaps it might happen. And somebody discovers those journals you wrote. So even 50 years from now, the journals you wrote 50 years ago have great value because they will endure, unlike the digital space. Anything that you write on your computer that you store in the cloud, and God knows I've got plenty of that, 400 years from now, it won't exist. It'll be gone, kaput. People talk about AI and how AI is going to take over the world, and it might. AI actually cannot take over the world. What AI can do is take over the world that we know. What we call the world is what we humans inhabit. So AI can definitely make a big dent in that. But that sparrow over there on the bird feeder, chirping away, having a little afternoon seed snack, that sparrow wouldn't know a hoot about AI, or doesn't know a hoot about AI, and the birds later will not know a hoot about AI either. So whatever you write has the potential to endure. Not that you need to get all fussed about it. It's just an interesting observation. I mean, definitely AI cannot write by hand, but we can. So all of this is to say, I've been going through some of my archives, and I have uncovered some stuff that I wrote many, many years ago. And so I was thinking today about how I would like to approach this show. And it occurred to me that it might be fun just to read some poetry, not just any poetry. In my archives, I uncovered a notebook. And the notebook probably has 50 or 60 poems in it. I won't read 50 or 60 poems today. It has a lot of the material that I memorized all those years ago, plus some of my original work that I hadn't seen in ages. So I thought I would spend this time with you playing around a little bit and reading some of these pieces just for my own pleasure and give you a sense of what we were doing all those years ago when I was traveling around the country and performing poems and memorizing them. I was also writing as well. Unlike what you might think, I was not a poet particularly. I didn't really know exactly how to do it. I made a lot of efforts to generate work that I thought would pop, that might impress you. And when I did generate the work, I wasn't sure if I liked it or not, asking all the same questions. Is it good enough? Do you like it? I didn't understand then what I understand now. It's not about whether you like it or I like it, or is it good enough or not good enough. I'm not discounting excellence here. I do want my work, as I expect you want your work, to be received well, to have an excellence around it. And what I've learned is the only way to have that happen is just to keep doing it. And eventually stuff spins out and it holds water, it holds up, and it becomes valuable or more valuable with time. So what I'd like to do now is read a piece of poetry I wrote 25 years ago. And I was traveling around the country. I don't remember what town it was in. I always think I was in West Virginia in a small town. I think it sounds good. You know, once upon a time in West Virginia, late at night in a small town in a hotel, I looked out the window and saw this lonely street. I suppose I could put Kansas in there. I could say Georgia. I could say almost anywhere. Regardless, I was somewhere. And I did look out on this lonely street from a hotel that I was in, and I vaguely remember a river nearby, maybe no river, and it was lonely. So I jotted this piece down, and I'd like to read it for you now. And the reason I would like to read it, I had a fantastic relationship with my grandmother, who was a poet, and my mother, who was quite well read. And when I read this piece to her, she felt like it had something. She said, that piece about the street has something. I don't know what it is, but it has something. Well, true to my colors, I shoved it in a notebook, and that was that. So as I was going through my archives, I found this. So I'm going to read this to you now because I liked it then, and I've read it over a couple of times, and I like it now. And after that, we'll go on with some other poetry, a little bit of story and backstory about what the pieces mean to me and why I'm choosing to read them. So here's this piece. Now picture West Virginia late at night, somewhere in a little town, looking out over the street with a river nearby. God, talk about overdoing it. Here it is. It's a late night on Pettisville Street. The whole town's still as a stump. Somewhere near here, a car radio moves new love along. Just down the street, the only red light in town hovers above the emptiness. I've always thought that there's something about a red light dangling at night that incites a luscious sort of anarchy that makes you just want to go down there and run the damn thing. If there was ever a night for a broken heart, this is it. People don't have time for broken hearts anymore. Their cars won't start. The kids are hungry. The cat pees in the corner. Or the grocery bag breaks and 24 eggs Humpty Dumpty onto the sidewalk. I'm sitting here on this wooden step holding a ping pong ball, fragile as tissue. If a flame touches its side, it will vanish, helpless as a singed moth. I bounce it on the wall. It doesn't break. Do I control its rhythm as it makes a new moon arch back to my hand? Perhaps. But really, the ping pong ball is out of place without its table, its paddles, and its net. Am I like the ping pong ball? If you touch me with a match, will I catch on fire? What about my net, my tables, my paddles? What about yours? We've all been there before, asking 1,000 questions. It's not like we don't have the answers. We do. It's not like we don't have time. It's not hopeless. The night always has tomorrow. The moth will find the flame. Lovers will make love to their love songs. Someday, somebody may even put Humpty Dumpty back together. So for now, I'll just sit here and hold my ping pong ball, smile, and listen to the radio still playing in the distance, and think about getting up tomorrow and having a piece of pie with huge lumps of hot, sweet apples inside. And as for the red light, maybe it has nothing to do with stopping. Maybe it's just there, and you got to decide, are you going to go down there and run it or not? And that was Pettisville Street, a poem that I wrote many years ago. And I'm still asking that question. Do you go down there and run the red light, or do you behave yourself? I tend to stop at the red lights. I don't usually run them. I don't find that sensibility all that rebellious. And yet, if you were living in a small town with very little to do, and you were young, and maybe there was only one red light, or maybe three, not many, lovers in the cars sounded the same every weekend or every night. The cafe on the corner is where you went on Sunday after church. You might, late at night, staring out your window, want to go down to that middle of that town square and just burn rubber all the way through that red light and head west into dawn and never come back. Of course, what happens later, after you've done such a thing, and maybe you've done such a thing yourself, what happens later is you start to think about that red light from a different perspective. The lovers in the car listening to their love song got married had children, turned 50, maybe turned 60. You did the same. Maybe you got married. Maybe you had children. Even though you ran the red light and burned the rubber and you headed west, maybe you settled down somewhere else. That hometown, that sensibility of place, begins to have deeper meaning as the years go by. So what was a desire, a longing, a dream to get out, get away, becomes a sense of self-defining purpose. And here's something I've been thinking about quite a bit lately. No matter how harsh the place you came from, or gracious and privileged, or whatever the range is, regardless of that location, that origin spot, it's important, especially if you're writing, especially if you're telling stories, to remember into it. And there are a lot of things when you remember into something, and here's a good little writing tip if you'd like to have this. Think about something that you're very familiar with, and write about what you don't know, or write about what you don't remember, really. I don't remember what time it was when I walked out of my family home for the last time and moved away to go to St. Louis or to Tampa, Florida, or maybe to Portland, Maine, wherever it is, San Francisco, flowers in your hair, who knows. You don't remember what time it was when you left. You probably don't remember exactly what you said. Might not remember the shoes you were wearing, although you might, who knows. You most likely won't remember the first thing you bought in a store somewhere along the way. Pack of peanuts, maybe you bought a soda, maybe it was a sandwich to go, one of those gut-wrenching, horrible, nasty hot dogs that you just can't avoid buying and eating, even though you know they're not good for you. You can't remember that. So if you're thinking back on a time and trying to generate some material about something, you can, with great ease, go deeper into what you remember by saying, I don't remember. You know, I don't remember exactly what time I got up this morning. I don't remember when I first noticed that it was almost daylight. I don't remember when I thought about the cat and hoped that the cat was still in the house because I'd left the window open and the door open to my bedroom, and maybe the cat got out and the coyotes chased the cat. I was concerned about that, although the cat was there. Most of what you have in your life, you don't remember. But when you say, I don't remember, there's something magical about it. It triggers the memories. And that is a good thing, I think. So when you work with this concept of I don't remember, you cue your psychology to start remembering. It's counterintuitive, I know. And when that I don't remember cue happens, you start to see things in your mind, or I see things. Maybe you have a different learning style than I do, but I see images. I imagine things. And when I say I don't remember what time it was when my father came home from work after spending all day at the power company, I still don't remember what time it was, but I do remember the Jeep and I driving up in the driveway. I remember him walking through the door. So the point isn't, do you get every fact right? The point is you start feeling the atmosphere of the scene. And when you start feeling the atmosphere of the scene, guess what bubbles up? Emotions. My father walking through the door. I was excited. I was uncertain. I wasn't quite sure what to make of it because I didn't know if he was tired, if he was angry, if he was mild-mannered, unjust, or feeling pretty good after a day's work and wanting to come in, have a little bit of supper, and play some Appalachian music. I could never tell. The atmosphere of the memory brings things out. And here's another little trick for you, or another little insight. No matter how much you remember something, no matter how powerful the memory, good or bad, when you start into the inquiry by saying, I don't remember, even the most treasured memory, the one you are most certain of, you will discover things you haven't thought of before. That does something to reinforce your confidence, your sense of narrative, your agency, that flag you planted in the ground that is you of who you are, your voice. And then when you put all those together, there's a sense of ease. And the ease comes because you can trust those things that bubble up from deep down will continue to bubble and bubble and bubble. All you have to do is ask. And a good way to ask is to say, I don't remember, and then move on from there. There are a lot of other ways to do it too. I don't remember is just one that's easily applied. So I encourage you to play around with that. And if you happen to be somewhere in the next few hours, or maybe tomorrow or the next day, sit down with a piece of paper and start out saying, I don't remember, and think of something that you know very well. And you will be surprised at how much better you will know it after you write for 10 minutes, I don't remember. So to give you a practical demonstration of that, I don't remember how many elementary school shows I performed. I don't remember how many students were in each one of the shows. I don't remember any of the names of the schools. I vaguely remember, which is kind of a variation of don't remember, any of the cities we went to. They all run together. It's almost like the American highway was one big highway in every town, even though it had a different name and people were there and they loved it and would never go anywhere. All those towns run together. I don't remember one from the other, but I do remember we performed all kinds of poems and we tried to be very funny with it. And we often would get students up and ask them to participate. So here's one of the poems that I performed. I haven't seen this. I just flipped through my book. I had this memorized many, many years ago. We used to perform this for third and fourth graders. It's titled The Embarrassing Episode of Little Miss Muffet. And it's written by Guy W. Carroll. And here it is. If you remember Little Miss Muffet, don't you? So something going on with the spider, right? So here she is, in a little bit of a different frame than maybe you might remember Miss Muffet. And the kids loved it, and I hope you will too. Little Miss Muffet discovered a tuffet, which never occurred to the rest of us. And as 'twas a June day, and just about noonday, she wanted to eat, like the best of us. Her diet was whey. And I hasten to say, it is wholesome, and people grow fat on it. The spot being lonely, the lady not only discovered the tuffet, but sat on it. A rivulet gabbled beside her and babbled, as rivulets always are thought to do, and dragonflies sported around and cavorted, as poets say dragonflies ought to do. When glancing aside for a moment, she spied a horrible sight that brought fear to her. A hideous spider was sitting beside her, and most unavoidably near to her. Albeit unsightly, this creature politely said, "Madam, I earnestly vow to you, I'm penitent that I did not bring my hat. I should certainly otherwise bow to you." Though anxious to please, he was so ill at ease that he lost all his sense of propriety and grew so inept that he clumsily stepped in her plate, which is barred in society. This curious error completed her terror. She shuddered and, growing much paler, not only left Tuffet, but dealt him a buffet, which doubled him up in a sailor's knot. It should be explained that at this he was pained. He cried, "I vex you, no doubt of it, your fist like a truncheon."
"You're stealing my luncheon,"
was all that she answered.
"Get out of it."
And the moral is this: be it madam or miss to whom you have something to say, you are only absurd when you get in the curd, but you are rude when you get in the way.
And that was The Embarrassing Episode of Little Miss Muffet by Guy W. Carroll. I don't remember how many times I performed that poem for school students. And I don't remember how many volunteers I brought up on stage.
but I do remember the structure. So how many characters are in Little Miss Muffet, the embarrassing episode?
Well, the narrator's there. That's me in this case. Then, of course, you have the spider, and then you have Little Miss Muffet.
So when I performed the piece, I would ask for two volunteers, the spider and Little Miss Muffet. So kids would raise their hands. They had no problem with it. They weren't shy at all. And I would pick the first ones that popped up, usually the most excitable ones, put their hands up first. Sometimes I'd pick the little shy one in the back who timidly raised his or her hand, bring them up on stage and assign them the role. Now you're going to play the spider and you're going to play Little Miss Muffet. So even though the lines are short, at the very end, the acting out is quite dramatic. So the spider would hide behind the chair. Little Miss Muffet would walk on stage and she would discover the tuffet, and then she would sit on it and she would preen and do whatever she did with her Miss Muffetness. And so the spider was lurking in the corner, and then finally the spider would come up, and then the spider would say, "Madam, I earnestly vow to you I'm penitent," and the spider was all penitent. It was great fun. Every child did it a very different way, and they always laughed and enjoyed themselves, and the spider chased Little Miss Muffet around. Sometimes Little Miss Muffet would turn the tables on the spider and swat the spider. You never knew what would happen. I haven't done that so much with adults. I don't know how inclined adults would be to lurk behind the chair while Little Miss Muffet showed up, but it is a lot of fun. And what we did back in the day, and I still do it now, we scripted these poems. And what I mean by scripted is even take it further than the embarrassing episode of Little Miss Muffet. There are lines in here. So you have three characters, and even though the poem is short, it's only 1 minute, 53 seconds, 2 minutes, 2 minutes and 30 seconds if you play it out on the stage, there's a lot of wealth and richness in it. And of course, you can imagine when students get committed to playing the roles inside of a poem, they don't have to spend much time studying what it means, what value it has, what literary message is happening. They intuitively absorb that information by playing the roles in the poem. And what we did also discover during that time, we discovered that it didn't really make any difference whether a poem had characters in it or not. You could still break any kind of poem down and turn it into a scripted piece where two people are having a conversation using the poem as the script. As I said earlier, what I like to do is have a long conversation over an hour doing a show like this. Right now, I'm watching, I think it might be Ernie, I'm not sure, a tractor in the field about 100 yards away baling hay. It's just now summer, the end of June. How fast spring has gone. The tractor's turning, the hay bales are falling out, and time is moving on. You can script and story almost anything. I got off on that just because I looked up and there the hay baler was. Back to scripting the poems. When you script a piece, you end up going into those places that you never expected. And I think that's really, really valuable. So what I'd like to do now is carry this a little further with a poem that you wouldn't expect to be scripted, and yet doing it in two voices, just to give you a sense of how, even though you might be there on your own studying text or working with text, you can play with it as if there were a dozen people in the room. Why in the world do such a thing, you might be wondering? Well, the reason why is when you play with text, you learn how to trust your impulses. Not necessarily your creative impulses, more like your street smart impulses. You know, when you've been to a party, or maybe you've been pulled over for a speeding ticket, hopefully you don't get the speeding ticket, but the blue light flashes behind you and you start getting nervous and you think, oh my God, my insurance is going to go up and I'm going to have to pay a bundle for this. That's happened to me a couple of times. Probably has happened to you. And you may have, over the years, been stopped and managed to have the officer say, okay, you're good. Just go away with a little bit of a warning. I'm not guaranteeing this, but when you learn to think quick by doing this kind of work, when you're out on the street, and when I say out on the street, that means you're headed to the grocery store, that means you're maybe pulled over for a ticket, that means you're just out in the world, or the whole world is the street, really, in my mind. You learn how to think a little faster, and that takes a little bit of practice. But what I'd like to do now is to give you an example of how a fairly complicated poem that I haven't seen in ages, I'm just looking at it, is called Innocent Songs, and it's by E.E. Cummings. And if you know anything about E.E. Cummings, he played with words in unusual kinds of ways. So what I would like to do is to read this relatively short poem and just see how many voices pop up as I'm reading it. Will I know any more afterwards? Will you? Probably not. Maybe you will. Let's hope so. But what you will get a sense of is how I have learned to trust what's coming out. And when you learn how to trust what's coming out, you also knock your internal critic off the perch a bit, because you're not trying for perfection here. You can't try for perfection. It's already been done. You're not really trying for anything except the experience. So here it is, the Innocent Songs. In just spring, when the world is mud luscious, the little lame balloon man whistles far and wee, and Eddie and Bill come running from marbles and piracies, and it's spring when the world is puddle wonderful. The queer old balloon man whistles far and wee, and Eddie and Bill come dancing from hopscotch and jump rope, and it's spring. And the goat-footed balloon man whistles far and wee. Hist, whist, little ghost things, tiptoe, twinkle toe, little twitchy witches and tingling goblins, hobnob, little hoppy happy toad in tweeds, tweeds, little itchy mousies with scuttling eyes, rustle and run, and hide, 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 whisk, whisk. Look out for the old woman with the wart on her nose. What she'll do to you, nobody knows, for she knows the devil, the devil. Ouch, ouch, the devil, ouch, ah, the great green dancing devil, 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 whee. Tumbling hair, picker of buttercups, violets, dandelions, and the big bullying daisies. Through the field, wonderful, with eyes a little sorry, another comes, also picking flowers. And that was E.E. Cummings' poem, Innocent Songs, or as many people know it, In Just Spring. So that was an example of how, when you let yourself go freeform, still working within structure, you can play around with your voice. I have no problem playing around with my voice and trying to go high, go low, futz around. I'm not too worried about if it sounds right. I do want to get it somewhat interesting. The point is to let yourself flow with it. So if you would like to practice this, it's not that hard to do. Just get some text and play around with it. You probably did it when you were a kid. Kids use all kinds of little voices to play around. If you've ever had a set of dolls or maybe a set of stuffed animals, each stuffed animal has its own voice. I used to play around with stuffed animals in some of the creativity workshops that I taught, and There was one, especially his name was Boris the Lion. And Boris was, he was very opinionated like this, and he could always tell me exactly what I needed to do. Nave, have you forgotten your glasses? Come on, man, get it together here. Gee whiz, you dilly-dallying around. You gotta ever get anywhere. Let's go. Now, I admit, Boris sounded pretty critical, but I got a kick out of it. And you can develop all kinds of possibilities. You can even do puppet fingers. Your right index finger could be one character. Your left index finger could be another one. So I'm going to try this right now. My right index finger is named Billy, and my left index finger is named Sylvie. So here's Billy speaking.
Well, Sylvie, it's good to see you again. It's been quite a while.
Yes, Billy, I do believe it has been a while. I haven't measured it. I can't say I've missed you all that much.
What do you mean you can't say you've missed me all that much? I thought I was a missable kind of character.
Well, no, Billy, actually, you're about as missable as an old Coke can.
An old Coke can? Well, what do you mean, old Coke can?
Well, you know, I just, you know, just toss you out and move on my way.
Well, that doesn't make me feel very good. Sylvie, I don't like that.
Yes, Billy, well, I know. You'll forgive me one day. But for now, I'm off to the mountains. I'll see you later.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll just feel bad by myself.
Well, I guess you will.
Now, that was Billy and Sylvie, my right index finger and my left index finger. Did that make sense? Did it have any drama to it? Had a little bit. Was it precise and well-crafted? No, it was an improvisational effort. And yet, when you listen to Billy and Sylvie having their repartee, and then you listen to the E.E. Cummings poem, In Just Spring, you can see how when you play around with your voice, and you let your imagination guide you, you can develop some fairly interesting situations. Now, what good is it? It's good because of a number of reasons. One, it's entertaining. Not to anybody else, it's just entertaining to you. It's a bit like singing in the shower. Two, it actually does lower your blood pressure. Again, if you're doing it privately, if you're in front of a whole bunch of people, your blood pressure goes up. But if you're doing it privately and you're just having fun with it, there's something chemical that goes on in the system, and it just makes you feel good. It makes you forget time. Three, it focuses your attention on the details around you. You might not think that's a benefit, but as I'm sitting here at this round table in the afternoon with my two fingers pointed up to the sky, Billy and Sylvie, I'm looking at my fingers in a different way. I now will forever think of my two fingers as characters in a little play that I created. So your awareness becomes heightened. So these are some of the reasons why this kind of work is important. And another reason why I like to do it solo, because I am developing this as I go. With my water bottle on the table, with my notebook in front of me. I didn't even have any sense I was going to do the E.E. Cummings poem, and I really didn't think Billy and Sylvie were going to show up, and yet they did. Now, all of this brouhaha and carrying on with verbiage must lead to something. Well, in the work that I do with writing, composition, storytelling, I work with the concept of the imaginative storm. I've mentioned it quite a few times on this show. From the imaginative storm to the creative form. So all of this improvisational material comes from the stormy imagination. The form comes from drawing the material that you've stormed out of your imagination and put into some kind of form, which you then present to the public. So what I'd like to do now, love to read a couple of poems that I've written. I'm more of a storyteller, poetry writer than I am a classic poetry writer. I really love storytelling. And these two poems come from my book, 100 Days, Poems After Cancer. I wrote this a while back. It's a beautifully designed book.
And it works really well as a gift for people who are dealing with cancer. I just lost a friend this week from the dreaded disease and got news from another friend. She's dealing with it. So it's out there, my friends. It's out there. Here are a couple of poems from that book. And they're not about cancer. They're about me healing after the cancer I experienced and the surgery. So it's a healing book. So here's the poem. It's titled 33, Jesus Going North. Out on the Great American Highway going west on I-40 around Little Rock, Arkansas in 2004, I noticed a neon sign. Divorce classes in progress. Call Antioch Full Gospel 329-5133. I was already divorced, so I had no reason to dial, but that didn't stop me from thinking of heartbroken people with sad eyes as I drove west through light rain, past farms, fields, a Bible factory outlet, floodplains, and a Mack truck with Jesus painted on the side. Yesterday, driving north from Black Mountain, North Carolina to the Presbyterian village of Montreat, I slowed for a bearded man shouldering a cross with a wheel attached to the bottom, rolling along the white line. He smiled and pointed to the sky. Today, wind, rain, lightning, and thunder disturbed the afternoon. I relaxed on the screened-in porch overlooking Lake Eden and thought about how I'd veered away from Jesus, pulling his cross up the road in the afternoon sun. And that was poem number 33, Jesus Going North, from my book 100 Poems, Poems After Cancer. Now here's poem number 53, Hummingbirds. A hummingbird weighs 6 grams and fast dives at 60 miles an hour. When I was 6, Uncle Johnny claimed God gave hummingbirds sharp beaks so they could fly through little boys. After that, I was more afraid of hummingbirds than rabid dogs, black widow spiders, poison ivy, polio, copperheads, chickenpox, and hornets. I had visions of hummingbirds cutting through my chest. Last night at Paul Pasquarella's house, dozens of hummingbirds buzzed his feeders, darting, diving, and whirling around. Yeah, I was a little afraid. Even so, I thought, how could I have ever believed those shiny little hummingbirds could cut through anything but air? And that was poem number 53, Hummingbirds, from my book, 100 Days. So that's a couple of examples of form after all the imaginative work. I did spend a fair amount of time editing all 100 of those poems. Sometimes I think maybe I overdid it. It's hard to say. You work your art, your pieces, whatever you're creating, until you feel like it's done, and then you have to just sign off and move on. So that's what I did with those pieces. The main reason that I wrote those 100 poems, I was recovering from surgery, and I didn't have anything else really to do. So I thought if I write one piece a day, I will somehow maintain who I am, maintain my relevance, maintain my momentum. I suppose if I hadn't written those poems, one a day, I still would have maintained a certain kind of momentum, but I wouldn't have the book. So I showed up and I did the work and I tried to continue to be myself. So in a sense, I hadn't lost myself, but I was looking for parts of myself that I thought I might lose. And so with that in mind, let's return for a moment to another E.E. Cummings poem titled Maggie and Millie and Molly and May. And it's about 3 girls who go to the beach. They're looking for something. And each one of them finds something. And this is a little story about what happens. Maggie, Millie, and Molly and May by E.E. Cummings. Here you go. Maggie and Millie and Molly and May went down to the beach to play one day. And Maggie discovered a shell that sang so sweetly she couldn't remember her troubles. And Millie befriended a stranded star, whose rays 5 languid fingers were. And Molly was chased by a horrible thing that raced sideways while blowing bubbles. And May came home with a smooth, round stone, as small as a world,
and as large as a loan. For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find at the sea. And that was Maggie and Millie and Molly and May by E.E. Cummings. I like the idea of going to the sea and finding myself. I'm not sure if I've lost myself at the sea or not, but I do think about the sea a fair amount, even though I'm from the mountains of Western North Carolina. I was a mountain lad. Didn't have much to do with the sea, except in the summertime, my father and mother would load us up in the 55 Chevy and take us down to Myrtle Beach and camp out at a place called Arrowhead Campgrounds. I remember going to the sea with my brother, and once my brother David was stung by a jellyfish. And I remember my mother nursing him, and apparently the jellyfish did get all over David. So David didn't find himself at the sea. He found the jellyfish, which was a bit of a problem. That was a long time ago. Recently, I did go to YouTube, and I looked up Arrowhead Campgrounds, Myrtle Beach, and sure enough, I discovered all of these old videos of people camping out in their travel trailers, their tents, during the 1960s at Arrowhead at Myrtle Beach. And it was really quite fun to look at it because it did remind me of what I experienced when I went down there. So when you do this kind of research, if you will, these kind of explorations like I'm doing now with this show, it takes you into these areas that you don't remember. I don't remember really all that much about Arrowhead Campgrounds at Myrtle Beach. I don't remember how long it took us to drive down from Asheville to Myrtle Beach. I do remember we had to drive down the old Saluda Grade, which is just south of Hendersonville, North Carolina, headed toward Tryon, North Carolina. There was no such thing as Interstate 26, just the old Saluda Grade. And I don't even know why they called it old. They did refer to it as that, and my father referred to it as that, and it was a windy, windy road, and you can still drive it to this day. Nothing happened to the road other than the interstate came through, and everybody travels the interstate because it's twice as fast, but back then, there were no options. And I remember I used to sit with the window down, and I would put my arm out the window, and I wanted my arm to get brown, something about tanning that made me feel important. I wanted a brown arm. So my little arm hanging out the window, going down the old Saluda Grade, looking at all the kudzu growing up over the trees. So I remember that to this day. That became part of me, just like everything else that I experienced as a child became part of me, and everything that I experience as an adult. Everything you encounter, you take in. It becomes part of you, and you become part of it. Your interior is like a landscape that you can travel through. It's a wilderness. Some of it is explored, some of it is not, and yet it's always there to explore, like traveling around the country. Which reminds me of a poem I'd like to close with. Actually, I won't close with the whole poem. I'll close with a snippet from it. It's titled Lonesome Pine Special. I've recited it here before. It's all about the landscapes. Interior landscapes, landscapes that are outside of you. It's all about traveling. And this part that Charles Wright offers us talks about the old Saluda Grade. So here it is from Charles Wright's long poem, Lonesome Pine Special. A little illustration of the old Saluda Grade. And this is how I felt with my little arm hanging out the window in the sun headed to Myrtle Beach. In the world of dirt, each tactile thing repeats the untouchable in its own way and in its own time. Just short of Tryon, North Carolina, on US 176, going south down the old Saluda Grade, kudzu has grown up and over the tops of miles of oak trees and pine trees, a wall of vines 100 feet high, or used to be, into South Carolina, that would have gone for 100 more with the right scaffolding, rising out of the rock and hard clay and thin prickly ropes to snake and thread in daily measurable distances over anything still enough, long enough, and working its way out of the darkness and overhang of its own coils to break again and again into sunlight, worthless and everywhere, breathing and breathing, looking for leverage and a place to climb. It's true, I think, as Kinko says in his Idleness, all beauty begins upon disappearance, the bitten edges of things, the gradual sliding away into tissue and memory, the uncertainty and dazzling impermanence of days we beg our meanings from, and their frayed loveliness. And that was a bit of poetry from Charles Wright out of his long piece called The Lonesome Pine Special, all about traveling around, interior travel, exterior travel. And to close it out, I will include a little poem I wrote a few years ago. I don't even think it has a title. It's a bit aspirational. Here we go. Beyond the lands of your air-sweeping dreams, the wind returns again and again from the wilds of the known through the distant trees where shiny red hair mixes with bees, clouds above and the earth below, along the river that always flows beyond where you're standing, past what seems, will redeem your dreams when your breath floats high in the crow-white sky. On this good day, travel alone with little thought for what you own. Walk with yourself through the perfumed sage, or go to the shore where the curlews play. And you can too, for a moment or so, until the wind tells you it's time to go to who you are, to what you know, to where you soar, near or far, on the red-headed wind in your sky of bees. That little poem I wrote just offhanded one day thinking about how language works. And I think I might have had Maggie, Millie, Molly, and May in my mind when I said, or go to the shore where the curlews play, Maggie, Millie, Molly, and May. You see, when you take in as much as you can, keep your adult education going, if you will. I'm a big fan of education. I loved going to school. People wonder, well, what do you do with a college degree? It's not worth anything. Well, it's worth everything if you look at it from the point of view of intake, education, bringing things in, keeping them there, trusting they'll be there when you need them. And life itself is an education. We tend to lean into our curiosity. Or at least I lean into mine. I hope you lean into yours. I tend to enjoy what my imagination gives to me. I'm finishing the show, still sitting in Taos. Couple of dogs here, Marley and Luna. Marley's a huge lab, weighs over 100 pounds, monster thing. Friendly as he can be, he howls off key when the coyotes howl at night. I don't think Marley will ever be a decent coyote singer, but he does try. Luna's 6 million years old. I'm surprised Luna's still with us. She totters around, waddles a bit, and whenever I pass by, she whines, wanting to be petted. Simple stuff. Two dogs. Imagination. Sun's out. Day continues on. Afternoons come. The afternoons, the evenings, the mornings, moving along. And that, my friends, pretty much brings me around to the end of our time together. So little to say and so much time to say it in. That's what Charles Wright says. It's a little reversed of what you usually hear. Anyway, thank you ever so much for spending this time with me, allowing me to enter your world and be with you for a while. I'm grateful that I've been able to do this for as long as I have, and I'm learning more and more and more. Adult education, recording shows like this, trusting the beat, trusting the moment, trusting yourself, me trusting myself. Like E.E. Cummings said, you find yourself at the sea, even if you've lost everything else. Or maybe the sea is everywhere. So on that note, thanks ever so much for listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio.
Fertile Ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. This show airs first every weekend on WPVM-FM, Asheville, North Carolina, and KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM. Robin Collier, Mike Tilley, thank you for doing the same in Taos. I really do appreciate it. Walter Parks, thank you for the theme song, walterparks.com. For more on Walter's music, I love working with Walter. When I drive from Taos to Asheville, I often will take a little detour, go through St. Louis, visit with Walter and Margot for a couple of days, and then head on down to Nashville and on over to Asheville. If you would like to reach me, Nave at jamesnave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. Would love to hear from you, what's going on in your part of the world. And if you do like to write and you would like to join my little merry band of writers, we gather on Zoom call every Saturday, 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You can get the link for that by going to jamesnave.com, or you can email me and ask me about it. Would love to have you. The door is always open. It's a great community. It only lasts for an hour, but you can get a lot done in an hour. And actually, we only write for 10 minutes. How about that? So I think that pretty much covers it for right now. Once again, thank you ever so much for tuning in. And I do hope you come back sometime very soon. And until then, hey, maybe if I'm lucky, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
You're listening to WPVM 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And we have exciting news to share. We're officially expanding our identity to Radio Asheville, a name that truly captures who we've become over this decade. While we'll always be WPVM 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina for our legal ID, you'll now hear us as Radio Asheville throughout our programming. This rebranding celebrates not just our 10th anniversary under new management, but our deep connection to this amazing city we call home. Since 2015, we have transformed WPVM from a struggling station with few volunteers to a well-rounded station with unique and compelling programming, unlike any other in the region. Now, we'll be honest. We're a volunteer-run organization. So occasionally, you might hear a technical glitch. Perhaps we're broadcasting in mono instead of stereo, or a file has gotten stuck on repeat until someone catches it. When this happens, bear with us. We will always get it sorted out. And thank you to listeners who call in or message us when something's not quite right. Your vigilance helps us stay on track. This brings us to something special, our 10th anniversary fundraiser, celebrating both our evolution and the wonderful volunteer community that creates great programming for Asheville. If you can, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at WPVMFM.org. Click on the donate option when you get to the side. Or send a donation to WPVM at 34 Wall Street, Suite 407, Asheville, North Carolina, 28801. Whether you contribute financially or simply by listening, you're part of this community we've built together. So welcome to Radio Asheville, where committed volunteers create real programming for real people. Something that you cannot get from algorithm-dominated digital content.
So blind to treat our love so unkind, slipping, sliding, cheating, lying, not really, really trying, while our love was slow. Hands of time.
man. But there's one thing we can do, baby. We can leave those heartaches behind. Trade sadness for gladness, weakness for sweetness. Learn all the beauty of me.